I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Donald Trump has just concluded a press conference, his first in 6 months. CNN reported last night that President-elect Trump and President Obama both received briefings that included a summary of allegations about the incoming president, none of which intelligence officials could confirm, that indicated a possibility that Trump could be subject to Russian blackmail. And a controversy is raging around BuzzFeed's decision to publish the dossier, purportedly prepared by a former British spy who was on the payroll of the campaigns which opposed Donald Trump in the primaries and the general election. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, a flood of nominees are appearing at Senate confirmation hearings, and President Obama gave an emotional farewell speech last night in Chicago. We'll have reactions and analysis from reporters who are in the middle of the mix. Midday is coming up next. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. As was just mentioned, you have just heard a press conference by President-elect Donald J. Trump, his first press conference in 6 months. It has been a very, very busy day. We're going to pick up Midday now, and I'm glad you're with us. CNN reported last night that President-elect Trump and President Obama both received briefings that included a summary of allegations about the incoming president, none of which intelligence officers have confirmed, but that it indicated a possibility that Trump would be subject to Russian blackmail. He was asked about that in the press conference. There's also a big controversy, which Mr. Trump alluded to repeatedly in his press conference, controversy around BuzzFeed's decision to publish this dossier that was purportedly prepared by a former British spy who was on the campaign payrolls of opponents of Mr. Trump in the Republican primary and then the Clinton campaign during the general election. BuzzFeed published it. It's about 35 pages long with all sorts of allegations, again, that have not been sustained by any news organization or intelligence officials. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, there are a flood of nominees appearing at Senate confirmation hearings, and President Obama gave an emotional farewell speech last night in Chicago. So there's all sorts of stuff to talk about. We'll see how much time we have to get to as much of it as possible. But joining me on the line now from the New York Times Washington Bureau is Scott Shane. He's part of the reporting team that did an extensive report about Russian hacking during the election and during the campaign. He has reported on national security issues for the New York Times for some years. He's also former Moscow correspondent with the Baltimore Sun. Scott, thanks for your time this morning. I know, or this afternoon. I know it's a busy day for you.
Hi, Tom. No kidding. This Washington has not been the same since the election.
Yeah, that's for sure. And there's so many stories dovetailing into each other. Your first reactions to Mr. Trump's press conference?
Well, he covered a whole lot of different topics, including an extensive discussion of his, how his conflicts of interest will be handled. And I'll leave that to, real experts to explain or comment on. But, we have been focusing mainly on the Russian question, the intelligence agencies finding that it was the Russian government that hacked into the Democratic National Committee, into the personal Gmail of John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, and then arranged for that material to be leaked in an attempt to influence the election and essentially hurt her chances of becoming president and help Trump's chances. So, as folks probably know, Donald Trump for months expressed doubt about the possibility that Russia was behind the hacking and the leaking. He said it could be a 400-pound guy in New Jersey. It could be some guy on his bed. He said it could be China. He was pointing everywhere except Russia, and he said had a lot of nice things to say about Russia and Vladimir Putin, the Russian president in particular. So I guess what's changed now, quite clearly, is that he now accepts that the Russian government was responsible for the hacking and presumably the leaking as well, although he didn't address that directly. But I think he minimized the significance of it by immediately saying at the press conference that, Russia did this, but At one point, he said others might have also hacked the Democratic targets. And he said that other countries and people are hacking everything and us all the time. That's not wrong, but it misses an important distinction. Generally speaking, these days, the U.S. and other countries, the Russians, the Chinese, hack into other countries' computer networks and gather information. Basically, it's a new form of spying. And so they take this information and, you know, use it to inform their policymaking, you know, their diplomacy. And that's sort of hacking applied to traditional espionage. In this particular case, though, Russia took a very significant second step, and they arranged, according to the intelligence agencies, to have this information, the private emails from the DNC, the private emails of John Podesta, leaked by a couple of websites that Russian intelligence apparently set up, and also had it passed on to WikiLeaks, which made thousands and thousands of these emails public. And so in the view of not just the intelligence agencies, but a lot of independent observers of intelligence and politics, that turned what would have been a traditional espionage, sort of information-gathering mission, into an attack, a sort of information attack on the U.S. election and on the democratic process, because by leaking these emails, they were deliberately trying to undercut Clinton's campaign. So, and the intelligence agencies went on to, the American agencies went on to conclude that the goal of these operations was not just to hurt Clinton, but to help Trump. Now, obviously, Donald Trump has every reason not to want to accept that conclusion. And he has not actually accepted it. He's said, since reading the, you know, being briefed on the inside intelligence, the highly classified intelligence that the intelligence agencies are using to support their conclusions, he has said that he doesn't think the hacking had any influence on the election. He doesn't want to accept that, in effect, Vladimir Putin gave him an assist in his successful presidential campaign, because that, you know, sort of casts a shadow over his own efforts, and understandably he doesn't want to accept that. But at least he has now accepted that it is, in fact, the Russian government that was responsible for hacking those democratic targets in the election.
What do you make of the president-elect's contention about the intelligence community and the leaks, the fact that some of the information that he's being given in these intelligence briefings do, in fact, end up in the media?
Yeah. Well, what he's talking about, you know, he's complained about leaks already on several occasions. And it's interesting, every president goes through this, every new president goes through this sort of shakedown period where they are shocked to discover that things that are given to them in confidence, and sometimes even classified information that's given to them in confidence, then turns up in the media. And, you know, as somebody who's covered intelligence for a long time and has written stories based on classified information on many occasions, I personally feel that is necessary for the American public to understand fully what its government is up to. Classic examples from recent history would be the eavesdropping without court warrants carried out by NSA in the early years after the 9/11 attacks, and the use by the CIA of waterboarding and other so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. Those would not be known to the public if not for leaks, because they were classified and the government was making every effort it could to keep them from being known to the public. I think most Americans are probably glad we learned that information and could have a debate about both those topics, because in both cases, there was congressional action, there was reform, as a result of the debate. So, you know, I'm prejudiced because I'm a reporter, but I think that leaks have been part of the sort of information infrastructure of Washington for many, many decades, and I doubt that that's going to change just because Donald Trump has become president.
But given, given the terrible relationship that he's seemed to have gotten off on with the intelligence community, wouldn't this kind of thing serve to just exacerbate that? I mean, there seems to be less trust between the intelligence community and Mr. Trump, and Mr. Trump and the intelligence community, than there was even a week ago.
Absolutely. I mean, I will say that there is a legitimate debate that is going on now, and I'm sure will continue, as to whether the intelligence agencies made the correct decision in attaching a two-page summary of these really defamatory accusations, which they had not been able to confirm about Mr. Trump.
But that is extremely unusual, right? I mean, this is not something that has
precedent. That is very unusual. Generally speaking, they would only pass on information that they had some confidence was true. In this case, their rationale, as we've heard it, is that they thought this information was all over town, which it was. I mean, you know, I had seen these memos shortly after the election. We'd had them since then, and many other news organizations had them as well. And it's you know, remarkably, we hadn't no one had published any of this stuff, but. I think there's a legitimate question as to whether a more appropriate way to handle this would have been to say to Mr. Trump on Friday at his briefing on the Russian hacking, hey, you know, one other thing, oral, you know, in a kind of oral briefing, there is this sort of, you know, set of memos that's circulating through Washington that say, you know, there have been sex tapes made of you, that there have been bribe attempts and so on, and we have not been able to confirm any of this, but you ought to be aware of it because, you know, it's all over the place. And that might have been a smarter way to do it than to attach a written summary. But, you know, the agencies, the people from the agencies we've talked to have suggested that they felt that Mr. Trump might be angry with them if they had not let him know that this stuff was out there and was circulating. The question of leaking it is somewhat different. The as we understand it, the two-page summary of these allegations was given to President Obama, to President-elect Trump, and to the so-called Gang of Eight, which is the Republican-Democratic leaders of the House and Senate and of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. And so that's, you know, traditionally, if you give that information to all those folks, especially the folks in Congress, there's a good chance it's going to get out. And I'm sure there are Trump aides or Trump supporters who believe that this may be even the intelligence agency's revenge for the fact that, you know, in recent months, Mr. Trump has made a number of extremely critical remarks about the quality of the intelligence agencies, brought up the, flawed reports, wrong reports that the intelligence agencies had put out on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, he called them political and incompetent. And, you know, it's not impossible that he would see this as payback. But, you know, it's certainly fair to say that the new president and the intelligence agencies are off to a very rocky start.
And, of course, as you mentioned, it's not just the intelligence agencies that had this information. There were members of Congress, so who knows where these leaks, in fact, have come from. You mentioned that you and other news organizations have been privy to this dossier, to these memos, this information for some time, and you've all been trying to verify it to find out whether or not any of it is, in fact, true. And that's the reason you hadn't published it, neither you nor the Washington Post. BuzzFeed made a different call last night, and that's a different topic altogether. But as you go about trying to track down the veracity of the information that's in this dossier that's purportedly prepared by a former British intelligence officer, how do you do that? How do you verify the claims that he's made?
Well, you know, some of this stuff is close to impossible to verify. For example, the notion that Donald Trump was essentially cavorting with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel. We can confirm, and you know, it is true that he was in Moscow staying in a hotel at the time of these allegations. But how do you go about proving that there were, you know, prostitutes in his room? That's pretty difficult to check. On the other hand, some of these memos have some very specific things. For example, claims that a lawyer for Mr. Trump, Michael Cohen, had traveled to Prague to meet with Russian officials and talk about the hacking. So a couple weeks ago, I actually managed to reach the Russian official in Prague who supposedly had that meeting, who was alleged to have met with Trump's lawyer. He denied it and said he'd never met the lawyer in question and, you know, didn't know anyone from the Trump circle and, you know, said he had no idea where this information had come from. Then last night, Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, said that he's never been to Prague. I suspect that's probably true, though who knows. But it is, you know, such a checkable fact. It's, you know, in my experience, it's usually unlikely that someone's going to make a prominent public denial of something that is easily checked. So perhaps that meeting didn't take place. Maybe that was fabricated. If so, you know, there's a whole other chapter of this story coming, which is if some of this information was fabricated, who fabricated it, and, you know, with what purpose?
To what end, yeah.
To what end?
What do you know, or what do we know, about this former British intelligence operative? I mean, it seems like he's credible, he or she is credible enough to lead the intelligence agencies to say, you know, we haven't verified this, but you should still know about it. Do we know anything about this source? I mean, this is a person who was hired in the commercial market to do opposition research by first Republican candidates who were running against Mr. Trump and then the Clinton campaign, allegedly.
Yes. He is said to be an experienced intelligence hand, now retired, who was hired by this sort of Washington political research firm to go look into Trump's relationship to Russia. He supposedly made a number of trips to Russia in addition to talking to Russian contacts he had in Europe and other places. And, you know, I think this was sort of an effort to pass along everything that he heard. There doesn't seem to be an effort to filter it or vet it. He was sort of saying, like, here's what my sources tell me. And apparently he has a network of Russian contacts in Russia. So, we've heard from U.S. security folks that they know this guy and think of him as competent and honorable and have no reason to think he, you know, was part of some disinformation operation or made this stuff up. I think there is a question if the Russians knew that this former British intelligence agent was on his way to Moscow to check out, you know, Trump, and they know from the files that they undoubtedly have on any Western intelligence agent who's worked in Moscow, that, you know, here are his top 10 Russian contacts in Moscow. These are the people who he's undoubtedly going to see. You know, you can imagine that the Russians could have approached those people and said, hey, here's some information you can pass on, you know, true or not. And while generally speaking, the intelligence agencies, the U.S. agencies have said that they believe the Russian government was out to help, to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump, it's also conceivable that they were kind of hedging their bets and they wanted to damage and have leverage over both of the people, one of whom would become president. They seem to have mounted a very effective campaign to hurt Hillary Clinton. It seems at least conceivable that they also were working in, you know, using different means to hurt or to get leverage over Donald Trump.
Well, Scott, I know you're busy. You just have a few minutes left. Let me leave you with one other thought, and that is there is this notion, and you have reported that it seems fairly clear that the Russians did prefer that Mr. Trump be elected rather than Secretary Clinton. Reasons for that have been adduced to include that Putin simply had a grudge against Hillary Clinton for past grievances. But do we have any notion or any understanding of why that is? Is there a strategic reason? In other words, does Mr. Putin, do we have any evidence that suggests Mr. Putin thinks that simply Mr. Trump will be an easier adversary, who will be a person who's just more manipulable than Hillary Clinton?
Well, I mean, I think that's a debate. There's no question that Trump had a grudge against Hillary Clinton. He blamed her publicly for encouraging the very large protests that broke out in Moscow in 2011 against
Putin.
This
is Putin. Yeah, this is Mr. Putin has the grudge
exactly
against her.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Putin has said very nice things about Donald Trump. Trump, as recently as today, has returned the favor. And Putin has a history of close relationships with characters who are similar to Trump, meaning big-time business people who are also maybe a little less persnickety about Putin's treatment of dissidents and journalists and opponents. The case that comes to mind is Berlusconi, the former Italian prime minister, also media tycoon, big-time business person, who many thought had an authoritarian streak. So he may see in Donald Trump a sort of similar character. He may feel that, Trump is susceptible to flattery. One might conclude that from the public record so far. And maybe that he'll get have an easier time dealing with Trump than he would have had dealing with Clinton. Now, I must say that Donald Trump at today's press conference went out of his way to say the opposite, no one could believe that I'll be easier to deal with for Putin than Hillary would have been. So he thinks he's pretty tough.
What do you make of, and this will be my final query here, and we'll let you get back to writing for the New York Times, but there are people who are speculating, it's complete speculation, that one of the reasons that Mr. Trump is fairly generous towards Russia and Mr. Putin is because, in fact, he fears that they may have something on him. And is there any way of extrapolating? You've got a lot of experience in the national security field. Is there any way of extrapolating Mr. Trump's attitude towards Vladimir Putin to mean that it's credible, it's plausible that the Russians, in fact, might have some information that could be very damaging to Mr. Trump?
Well, that's what this unverified, set of intelligence memos is, that's the question that these memos raise. If, and I emphasize if, because there's absolutely no evidence that we have that it's true, but if, as the memos say, there are, for example, sex tapes or evidence of bribery by the Russian government, arranged by the Russian government, then they would hold, they would presumably hold some pretty strong cards that they could play against Mr. Trump, and their goal might be to influence his behavior, and part of his behavior might be to, go easy on Russia, go easy on Putin, go for friendly relations, not complain too much about Putin's behavior. So that is certainly a theoretical possibility. But I should emphasize again that we have no evidence at this point to think that it's true.
Scott Shane covers national security for the New York Times. He's joined us from the Washington Bureau of the Times. Scott, thank you so much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your future reporting on this and many other national security issues.
You're welcome, Tom. Take care.
You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're doing special coverage of the press conference held by President-elect Donald Trump, talking about a number of the issues in the news today. When we come back, we're going to talk to a former assistant managing editor of The Washington Post about this very controversial decision by BuzzFeed to publish this dossier purportedly prepared by a British intelligence officer that was summarized in an intelligence briefing given both to President-elect Trump and to President Obama. When we come back, we'll speak with Marilyn Thompson about that very controversial decision. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. We'll be back after a break. Thanks for joining us here on this special edition of Midday. Donald Trump has concluded a press conference, his first in 6 months. He spoke earlier this morning for about an hour. About 15 minutes of that was taken up by one of his attorneys explaining how the Trump Organization was going to be restructured, given the fact that Mr. Trump will assume the office of the presidency on the 20th of January. A lot of questions about Trump's business dealings and his potential conflicts of interest, as well as conflicts of interest by his children. Donald and Eric are going to be the people who will run his company under the plan that he was proposing today. Sherry Dillon is his lawyer who outlined the various tenets of that proposal. As she says, completely isolate business dealings of the Trump Organization from the office of the presidency. So she spoke for about 15 minutes. Mr. Trump spoke for the rest of the time. The press conference began with Sean Spicer, the recently appointed press secretary for the Trump administration, blasting the decision by BuzzFeed to publish a dossier reportedly put together by a British intelligence officer, now retired, that has very damaging information about Mr. Trump and allegations of perverse sexual acts and bribes and all sorts of wheeling and dealing that were very, very concerning and difficult. It is a decision that BuzzFeed made that is a decision that no other major news organization has shared and decided to do. BuzzFeed is the only one that decided to do this. Joining us on the line now is Marilyn Thompson. She's a former assistant managing editor for investigations at The Washington Post. She served for a while on the staff of Politico. She's currently with Kaiser Health News. Ms. Thompson, welcome to Midday, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
So talk us through this decision. There are many people, including Margaret Sullivan, who wrote an op-ed in today's Washington Post, calling the decision by BuzzFeed to release this information, which they did last night, very irresponsible. Talk to me about how the process in a newsroom would likely go when it comes to this, because this information has been on the street in the hands of people in Congress and putatively their staffs, as well as people from the Post, from the Times, from CNN and other organizations. How do you parse this out and talk through a decision as to whether or not to publish or not?
Yeah, I just read Margaret's very thoughtful column and was really struck by her assertion that this was beyond the pale and that we've crossed a very slippery slope. I would have to counter that I think the slippery slope has been in the process with the news media this entire election cycle. And there have been many decisions made by many different outlets, including some of the most respected outlets, to publish material such as the WikiLeaks material that they have not independently verified. We have reached a point in our media culture where speed and competitiveness has really changed a lot of the decision-making process as news outlets try to be more facile in delivering the news. And BuzzFeed's decision was interesting, yes. I mean, I read Ben Smith's column He is erring on the public's right to know, something that members of the media and the more elite reporting establishments have apparently had in their possession for months. It's almost a you-can't-win situation in the media right now. I just heard Trump blasting BuzzFeed as a failing pile of garbage. And I just recently, last week, had an experience dealing with BuzzFeed editors on a partnership, a story that we did on Tom Price and his work as a congressman on behalf of pharmaceutical companies. And I can tell you they went through the same kind of rigorous process in vetting the material that we were delivering to their doorstep that we would have gone through at the Washington Post when I was there as an assistant managing editor. They asked to see all backup documents. They reviewed those documents. They asked questions. They came back at us again and again. And that's what responsible news outlets do. There are often senior editor meetings to discuss the ethics pro and con of publication. And in many cases, the decision is made that the public deserves to know this information, as we saw during WikiLeaks and during much of the Clinton email releases.
Ben Smith made the point in his letter to the folks at work who work at BuzzFeed that the thing that tipped the scale is that, first of all, he was inclined to publish rather than not to publish, just generally speaking, as a modus operandi. But secondly, what was different to him, evidently, was that CNN had reported that this information was presented to both President Obama and President-elect Trump in an intelligence briefing in the form of a two-page summary that was attached as an appendix. Do you think that that changes the game? Does that fact, the fact that it was now reported by CNN by unidentified sources, that this information was included in an intelligence briefing, does that change the game and all of a sudden make an opening that's justifiable for BuzzFeed to publish this information, given the fact that virtually nobody else is doing it?
I believe that it does change the game. And as an editor, I ran a newspaper myself for a couple of years. I would have to say that I, too, sided with the public's right to know, especially in a matter that is getting wide attention by other news media, maybe in more cryptic form. It's interesting. I'm sure there'll be a lot of second guessing and analysis of this for weeks to come. But I was reading this morning how the New York Times, which published a sanitized version of the story in its pages, after BuzzFeed published the full document, it then went back into its story and added some selected materials from the document. My question as an editor and as an observer of the media in this very, very stressful time is how much reporting was actually done by any news media organization to try to take this document, investigate it, verify or refute any allegation in it. Reporters are operating under such intense competitive pressure and under such major restraints in what they can spend to go out and do stories. I'm not sure that was done with this, but I want to be convinced otherwise.
Well, I think certainly the New York Times, Scott Shane has said that they've been trying to verify this information for some time now. I know NBC News, Tom Brokaw and Richard Engel were on the air this morning talking about their attempts to talk to some of the sources that are mentioned in this dossier to try to verify the information. So I think there are people trying to verify, and that seems to be the point of the people who are criticizing BuzzFeed, is because they have not been able to verify any of the information, it was irresponsible to publish this. and Scott Chaney just made the point on this program just a few minutes ago that verifying some of this stuff is nearly impossible. It's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to actually come to a conclusive determination that this these things happened or did not happen.
Well, and that's absolutely true. And I would only offer the parallel situation of a trove of emails leaked in the heat of the campaign season, possibly influencing the vote, that were not verified, printed widely, involved Mr. Trump's opposition. And the campaign in that case refused to verify that these were authentic, and yet they were printed anyway. So we've been on a, I would only argue that we've been on a slippery slope. It reminds me of, you know, the classic scene in that Eddie Murphy comedy Norbit, where he's sliding down the slide into a pool of water. We are on treacherous ground.
Yeah, we may be sliding down a slide into a pool of something else besides water. I mean, the fact you mentioned WikiLeaks, you mentioned the emails that that were hacked from Mr. Podesta's account as well as the DNC. The president-elect today took pains to once again blame the DNC, saying that to a certain extent it's their fault because their firewalls were simply not successful enough. They weren't strong enough. But if we're going to be deluged with all of this unverifiable information, I mean, I wonder what makes BuzzFeed's publication any different than the story that was circulating on Facebook about Hillary Clinton running a child slavery ring out of a pizza parlor on Wisconsin Avenue.
Yeah, it's horrifying to think about. And you know, every media organization needs to be critically examining its processes at all times, and it needs to realize that it's operating in an environment that is hugely different than what I came up in years ago. You have to be quick, you have to be responsive, and you have to be right. Rules are the same.
What is your advice to the public, people who are not professional journalists, people who are not in the business of parsing out what's true and what's not true in terms of whether to publish or not? What's your advice to the person reading this document published by BuzzFeed? How does a person do what BuzzFeed purports we should all be doing, which is make up our own mind?
Well, I think we do that with every story that we read as members of the general public anyway. There are certain sources of news that I trust and that I rely on because I know their internal processes and I know that they go through the right steps. There are others that I don't. And, you know, Mr. Trump, I just read a very interesting analysis of Mr. Trump's media habits, which were quite revealing because he relies very heavily, according to this analysis, on Breitbart News, and in fact brought in a Breitbart News executive to a senior position. And Breitbart has had a reputation for many years as a perpetrator of so-called fake news. So we've all got some work to do. Those of us who have reputations and believe that we are very responsible guardians of the public trust, you know, we need to be weighing these things and talking among ourselves and with the public about how to correct some of these problems.
Marilyn Thompson is the former assistant managing editor for investigations at The Washington Post. She's currently with Kaiser Health News. She has joined us from their office in Washington. Ms. Thompson, I appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
That'll do it for this special edition of Midday. Tomorrow, we'll examine what shape and form anti-Trump activism may take as the new administration assumes power. Former congressional staffer Ezra Levin will join me. He's one of the creators of Indivisible, a practical guide to resisting the Trump agenda. And also joining us for that conversation, Baltimore-based Black Lives Matter activist DeRay McKesson. Plus, we'll have a theater review from our theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Lunch today provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Thanks so much for calling, or for listening, rather. Tomorrow we'll get back to your calls, comments, tweets, and emails. I'll look forward to seeing you there. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.